Welcome back to the Lumieres podcast with me, Jodie White. This podcast is a slowly weaving thread, bringing together people with a gift, a story, or a mission to share at the intersection where creative expression, holistic health, and grounded spirituality meet. My guest today is anthropologist Dr. Stephen Hugh Jones, who is a Life Fellow of King's College, Cambridge. Along with his wife Christine, Stephen spent 2 years in the late 1960s living alongside a village of Yucuna Indians in the Colombian Amazon, learning about their language, their customs, cosmology, and cultural traditions. They were even initiated into the tribe and given new names, forever connecting them to this community on the other side of the world. In this episode, Stephen shares his journey into anthropology and his lifelong research and support of the Yucuna people he became so close to. He also recounts in vivid detail the Yurupari initiation rite he undertook back then, which involved a hefty dose of ayahuasca in the darkness, amongst many other things. This is an absolutely fascinating conversation for anyone interested in hearing firsthand how an indigenous culture with minimal Western influence operates. You'll even hear about the story of the spirit without an anus. Before we get going, I must tell you that my first book, Chimera, Living Through Leukemia, a Memoir, is available now and receiving rave reviews. This book has been years in the making and I'm incredibly proud of it. It's available now in all formats, including an audiobook read by me. You can check it out online at bookshop.org, Amazon or Goodreads, or go to jodiewhite.co.uk/chimera to find out more. And I'll be speaking about Chimera at North Books in Hay on Wye during the famous Hay Literary Festival. And that is at 4 p.m. on Wednesday the 31st of May. Okay, let's take a breath. And now please enjoy this wonderful conversation with Stephen Hugh Jones. Until the next time, please take extra special care. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for doing this.
That's a pleasure.
Let's start off. Maybe you could introduce yourself to the world and the people who are listening. What is your... who are you?
I'm called Stephen Hugh Jones. I used to teach anthropology in Cambridge, but I'm retired. And now living in central Wales on the border with England. And my own anthropology is my kind of area interests are Amazonia in particular. That's what my expertise is in Amazonian Indians. But I've also written on mythology, rituals, symbolism, architecture, etc., sort of on the kind of thought philosophy end of anthropology.
Interesting. Okay, we'll dig into all that.
And I work in Colombia, but just inside the frontier with Brazil, exactly on the equator, which actually is quite important for a lot of work that I've been doing, because I mean, they say that they live in the middle of the world. In a way, they're right. And so they look up at the sun at midday and see it vertical in the sky, etc. So that's where I work.
Right.
And I work with people who are, turned out, I didn't know this at the time, but I first went there when I was 18 before going to university. And I hit very lucky because it turns out that the people we worked with are extremely interesting because they're kind of not like the usual Amazonian Indian mold. They're very sophisticated. They live in very large sort of ceremonial longhouses and with elaborate symbolic architecture, and they have elaborate mythology and ritual, etc. So it was extremely interesting. And I've spent the rest of my life working on that. At the moment, I'm writing a paper on a spirit without an anus.
Wow. Okay. I want to come back to that. Let's put a point in that. To use a phrase. I want to rewind a little bit and just let's go back to what led you to anthropology. Was this something that you were kind of very drawn to as you were starting your education and your professional
life? I was some of my life, my early life, when I was about 8 or 7 to 11 or 7 to 10, I can't remember exactly, I was brought up in Jamaica and I never looked back. I fell in love with the tropics and I've always been interested in natural history, kept animals and kept snakes and collected stuff and swam on the tropical reefs, etc. So I always wanted to go back to the tropics. And at school, I got interested in archaeology. And my parents sent me back to Britain to civilize me because I went a bit wild in Jamaica.
Oh, right. So did you get wild in Jamaica?
Well, I never wore any shoes or shirt apart from when we went to school. And we lived a sort of quite wild, tough existence. And I was no good at school. I wasn't interested in school. I was interested in the outdoors. And I could hardly read, write, or tell the time when I was sent back to Britain to civilize me by my parents. And
at what age did you go to Britain?
It must have been 9 or 10.
9 or 10, wow, yeah.
Yeah. And I was sent to a snotty British private school and teased mercilessly, but beat people up who teased me.
So was the Jamaican upbringing, I mean, you must have felt thoroughly Jamaican.
I spoke like Bob Marley and
Still speak like Bob Marley?
I can in the right circumstances, yes. If I'm with Jamaican friends, speak like that, yes.
And yeah.
So anyhow, that I then started reading about, having discovered archaeology, partly of holidays on beaches in Jamaica. There were lots of sort of axes made of shells and stone, and there was Arawak pottery and stuff. And I got interested in archaeology and also Amazonian Indians at a very early age. And I read everything I could about Amazonian Indians. My parents wanted me to study medicine, but I didn't want to study medicine. I wanted to spend life in the Amazon.
What were your parents doing in Jamaica?
My dad was a great sort of traveler, and this was the time of decolonization. Sure. So they were founding the University of the West Indies, and a team of academics, doctors, scientists, professors, etc., went out to make the new university.
Yeah.
So that's why we went there.
Ah, okay. Right, great. So then let's go back to where you landed in on the shores of England, and then into the perils of high school, as it were, secondary school.
Well, I didn't really like school because I felt out of place, but a biology master gave me a book by Wallace, who was the great British naturalist peer to Darwin. And Wallace wrote a book called Travels on the Amazon and Rio Negro, and he actually went to the area where I now do my research. And I read this book as a child, as a kid, and thought, wow, that's where I'm going. And so as soon as I left school, I headed straight for the Amazon, and I headed for Venezuela, but Venezuela was far too expensive because it was an oil boom at the time, an oil boom economy. So having gone on a ship from Britain to Venezuela, I got back on a bus and went to Bogota.
Okay.
And then ended up, having asked around to find Indians, I ended up on the frontier with Brazil, with people who were pretty, they'd been sort of working with rubber gatherers and they were in a bit of a sorry state. But I heard about this river to the south called the Pirapaná or Fish River. And people said, they'll kill you if you go there. And I didn't believe that. And so all the time I was at Cambridge studying anthropology, that was where I was going. And as soon as I had graduated in anthropology, and my wife Christine also graduated in anthropology, we headed back to this area called this river called the Pirapaná, and there we stayed for I think we did 22 months of actually living with them, and then came back and wrote our thesis.
How did they? How did the people that you eventually ended up living with? How did they? Were they welcoming? How did they kind of take to a couple of people from Europe coming in and wanting to kind of, observe and hang out with them and live with them?
The Pidar, as we call it, was a kind of refuge zone, because most of the people, there aren't tribes, they're
right.
Groups of people who all speak related languages. And most of the, and they live right across this huge area, there are about 20 or 30,000 of them.
Right.
Most of them had not only been mucked about by Catholic missionaries, but they'd also worked tapping rubber.
Right.
And the people we worked with, or the area in which the Pidai area, was a refuge zone because they in particular had got pissed off with the abuses of the rubber gatherers who raped their women and forced them into slavery. And so they'd killed several rubber gatherers, and that gave them an undeserved reputation for fierceness. But they had hidden away, basically, far up on the headwaters of the smaller rivers. And they had hardly been visited. They had been occasionally visited by sort of visiting missionaries, but the missionaries had only just arrived at the same time we arrived. And when we arrived, they were basically pretty frightened of white people, but they also had an intense resentment against them because of the abuse that they'd had in the past. So when these two extraordinary people, who obviously weren't Colombian, taller and whiter, arrived, fetched up in one of their houses and didn't bugger off in the morning, they are very polite in the sense that they all travel, so that if you arrive in a longhouse, you're always given a meal and told where you can sling your hammock. But unless you have proper business to be there, they expect you to go away in the morning. And we didn't go away. We just stayed. And we couldn't speak anything. They didn't speak Spanish and we couldn't speak their language. So we started off just basically sort of follow. If they went out to work, we followed them like dogs. So Christine went to the gardens and I went to the forest. And there was nothing, I mean, they were out all day. There was no point in staying back in the longhouse. And, I mean, it took a long, long time to learn the language. It's very difficult to learn a language if you haven't got an intermediary language. If you can't say, how do you say X in your language? It's bloody difficult. So we started off with gestures, and then the kids were great. The adults got very bored of teaching us how to speak. The kids and kept saying, you know, what's wrong with you people? Our kids learn to speak. Why can't you? But the kids were great because the kids would sort of adopt your perspective. So you'd say, I eat. And they'd say, I eat, not you eat. And then you'd point at them and they'd say, you eat. And then we eat, etc. And then you could go, yesterday we eat, and they'd say, no, I ate, etc.
Right.
So they were the people who taught us. And, I mean, it took, I guess, after two or three months, we could speak quite well. And then they started. The more we stayed, the nicer they were, but also the more they brought out all their resentments.
Okay.
I remember at one point Christine was with a group of women, and one of them handed her baby and said, hang on to this baby, I'm just going down to the river to bathe. Then she came back again and said, funny that, me leaving my baby with you. You know, a couple of months ago we thought you people were cannibals.
Wow.
So that turned the tables. I mean, it's usually us who say they are cannibals, which is not true.
That's amazing.
For them, they were the cannibals, we were the cannibals.
I wonder
cannibals.
where that came from.
Well, what? I think everybody is ethnocentric. So
right.
Other people are, you know, others are always the bogey men and bogey women of yourself. So we were their bogey people. And so they were a mixture of frightened, but the more closer we got to them, the more they began to bring out. They'd say, your people killed our people. And we say, no, it wasn't our people. And in a way, they were right, because actually our system, because, you know, the people who were buying the rubber were basically the Europeans, the West.
Yeah, yeah.
So in a sense, they were right that we did kill their grandparents, although not personally.
Sure.
So, but by the, you know, after 4 or 5 months, they were really nice to us and sort of took us in, and this got better and better. And then in this area, there's this area, one of the reasons it's famous is because they have this so-called secret cult called Juru Pari, which was supposedly the travellers had called this devil worship, etc.
Oh, and right. The missionaries called it devil worship, yeah, of course. Yeah.
What it is that you have a series of flutes and trumpets, sacred flutes and trumpets, which women aren't allowed to see. And when you're initiated, the young boys are shown these flutes and trumpets and you get whipped and you have to fast for a month and all the rest of it. So
is this something that's like, it sounds like there's quite a strong division of the sexes in terms of activity.
Very strong,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. The and long, in the initiation, the rites of
that,
passage.
The initiation is part of that. The longhouse has a front men's door in the east and a women's back door in the west. And the visitors and the ritual spaces in the front of the in the east, and the sort of cooking domestic area is in the back at the west, and along the top of the roof beam along the top of the house is the path of the sun, and midday is called the seat of the sun because there's a central pillar in the roof which represents the sun's house, etc. So that gender divisions are terribly important, but they're also about people marry women who have to speak a different language from their own language. Everybody's multilingual, and so that from the perspective of my group who live in our longhouse, the outsiders are women or wives, are wife givers. But obviously from the other side, it's the reverse. But so that the distinction between men and women, insiders and outsiders, my kin versus marriageable others, etc., is all phrased in gender terms.
Right.
So it's terribly important.
And is that reflected in the, is there a cosmological connection with the where the placement of the doors are in terms of the male door?
Yeah.
Is that related to the sun or the moon or that kind of thing?
Yes, because the east is the source of life, and the house from the perspective of a man, the house is a male figure with his head facing east, with his mouth as the front door and his anus as the back door.
Right.
From the perspective of a woman, the house is a female with the front door as her vagina, and the back door is her mouth, etc.
Okay.
So that everything is hit, and the house is the body, is the cosmos, etc. That's how it. I mean, it's very complicated to
work all this out. Yeah.
But I mean, this is what I spend my life writing about. But and we both wrote about this and discovered it. But it's terribly complicated, because, for instance, when you walk, every time you go into the house, the act of going into the house has cosmological implications. The act of moving, what you bring into the house through which door, has implications. So that whereas I wrote about male initiation rites, which were coming in through the front door, Christine, my wife, wrote about the women's production of food, which was going on at the back of the house through the female door. And inasmuch as the men are making new life by initiating the boys, the women are making new life basically by baking bread, which is, I mean, we have vulgar expressions like she's got a bun in the oven for pregnancy, so that they too have this idea about cooking as creating life.
Right. So and they're passing on the kind of their sort of in, the female initiation is the passing on of the skills of the women
exactly,
to the girls.
Yes. And when you make the bread they eat is actually made of manioc or
like cassava kind of stuff.
Yeah, cassava.
Yeah.
But the cassava they use is bitter manioc, which is deadly poisonous, but which has a much higher starch content or tapioca content, which is why they prefer it, because they know how to deal with it.
Right.
So that in cooking, what they do is they separate the starch and from the fiber, which is the bones from the flesh, and then they recombine it into bread. In other words, they're making children each time they cook bread. So women are making children and give birth to children whilst men are making male adults, and their rituals are a ceremonial giving birth to new men.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it all fits together.
Wow. That's incredible. So it must have taken you a long time to be there and to kind of piece together this. I mean, is this something that you've, the cosmology, is this something that you've pieced together over a long, long period of time, not just the time?
I'm still doing it.
Yeah.
I mean, I when I was way back when in the 70s, both of us wrote books, Christine about what I've just told you and me about the initiation rites. And that, I mean, you can only piece all this together. You have to learn. There are an elaborate series of myths or stories, and the stories act as a kind of, you have to understand what the stories are about, because they look as if they're just stories. But once you start digging down, you understand how it works. And I'm still doing it. It's extremely complicated, but I now understand pretty well, and I speak the language and they recognize me as somebody who really knows what I'm talking about, but it's taken me my whole life to get to that position.
Wow.
They have kind of they're not really shamans, they're kind of more like priests, they're tribal elders who are the experts in this mythology and ritual. And they run these initiation rites, etc. And they are the people who know about the cosmology. And they now talk to me as more or less an equal and recognize that I know what I'm talking about. But it's taken, as I say, the whole of my life to get there.
Wow. Let's dig into the initiation process that you were talking about there. What sort of age are the boys when they're kind of called to this process? Is it something that they have to reach a threshold? Is it like 16? Is like this kind
normal,
of...
slightly younger? No, it coincides roughly with puberty.
Yeah, sure.
Although, I mean, it isn't necessarily linked to physiology, so that when I was initiated, I was already past puberty, and there were another couple of guys who were going through the rite who were also past puberty. So that.
But, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So at what point did you... So I guess is this something that that happens like in terms of at certain points in their sort of the cosmological year? Or maybe their time works differently, I imagine, but... Is it like when there's a big enough group and it's a certain time of year with the sun is in a certain place, then there's an initiation?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, in part, what the rite is doing is gearing up the human life cycle with the cosmic life cycle.
Sure.
So that you are, I mean, the rite ideally happens at March, April time. If you look, if we in Britain look up in the sky roughly at this time of the year, we can see at dusk, we can see the Pleiades rising in the sky. And for us, the rising of the Pleiades indicates the beginning of winter. If you are on the equator in the middle of Amazonia, the rising of the Pleiades indicates the end of the summer and the beginning of the rainy season. So that is the kind of period of, that's the beginning of their year, whilst for us the rising of the Pleiades in roughly in November, December is the end of our year, so that the Pleiades are of critical importance. So that by initiating the boys at this point, and the Pleiades also, it's very complicated to explain, but it's geared up with it's obvious actually, the solstices are December is the winter solstice. So there's a link between the Pleiades and the sun and the solstices.
Okay.
So that is also being marked here. And so, yes, I mean, it's all about time, but it's about bodily time, social time, and cosmic time are all being put into, which is, I mean, we have the same idea that we happen to have a story, what I'd call a mythology, a Christian mythology, in which the birth of our God, Jesus, is our birth. He's born at the middle of winter. Mm. In other words, it's the renewal of life at the end of life, and it's life and death, etc. And he's crucified at the equinox at Easter, etc. So that, again, our ritual calendar is geared up with our solar calendar.
Yeah. Do you think the the Christian mythology was designed deliberately to link into those cosmological?
Absolutely, yes.
It's a bit of a coincidence that it's so close to the solstice.
Well, it's not. Yes, exactly. It's no coincidence at all. And I mean, all of these, I think it's that's what I was talking about in Prestine the other night, is about initiation rites and death rites. And one of the key themes of most funeral rites or death rites is the idea of rebirth, mm-hmm. and the idea that the tomb is the cradle of the soul is very much present in Northwest Amazonia. It's not exclusive to Christianity. It's all over the world. It's a standard theme.
Sure.
And what is happening in the initiation rites is about that too, because the flutes and trumpets, the sacred flutes and trumpets that the boys are shown, are the bones of the first ancestor. So when you bring the flutes and trumpets back together again, you assemble them all. They're kept secret, or they're kept underwater in the rivers. But when you bring them into the house and assemble them all together as bones, you're recreating your ancestor. And when you blow through the flutes and trumpets and give them voice, your ancestor comes back to life, so that the ancestor represented by the flutes and trumpets comes and adopts the initiate as his children. But that adoption, the story is that the ancestor ate the initiates for disobeying the restrictions they have to go, and then gave the parents back their bones. We vomited them up into a compartment, which is exactly the same compartment which you're forced to stay in after seeing the flutes and trumpets. And so that the ritual recreates or reenacts this story of swallowing and regurgitation.
And then it sort of links them with their lineage all part of becoming part of
that in order to become part of the lineage, you have, that's basically, it's not the language of blood which we have, bloodlines. It's actually that you are adopted as the child of this ancestor, so that's how you become a member of the lineage. Until you are adopted by the ancestor of the lineage, you ain't in the lineage. And that's why getting initiated was so important for us doing our research, because at that point I was, and we were both now, really part of the society.
So were you invited to be part of the initiation? Did they say, was there a point where they were kind of like, well, next week we're doing a thing, and we want you to be involved, we want you to go through this?
It was something that, I mean, all this stuff is very secret, and I had I'd always wanted to know about it, and they kept talking about it, and I never, you know, I thought, gosh, this would be amazing if ever.
But you don't want to push it.
If only, exactly. And they were very secretive. And then one day they just said, okay, Stephen, you're going to be initiated. And no notebooks, no tape recorders, no nothing. If you're going to do it, you're going to do it properly. And properly I did it. I mean, you start off by having huge amounts of tobacco snuff blown with a blowpipe up your nose, and then you're drugged up with ayahuasca.
Oh, so it's okay. And then is that over like a period of time, or is that just like the first kind of couple of days, or how does what's the structural aspect to it?
Well, it starts out your
painting. So it's a cleansing, I imagine, because tobacco and ayahuasca are obviously very cleansing of the body, the physical body.
Yeah, and it also kill you. You're painted from head to toe in black skin dye, and then you have snuff blown up your nose, and it's like having somebody hitting you in the face, but from the inside rather than the outside.
Mm, that's what they call happy, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
With the powder.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Becoming very popular in a lot of contemporary spiritual circles these days.
Oh, really? I've got some upstairs. And then you're given ayahuasca and you are basically dead. You're not allowed to speak and you're not allowed to be seen by the women, so that you're socially dead. You have to move slowly.
Does this take place in a ceremonial longhouse?
In the longhouse, they shut the back of the they shut the women in the back of the longhouse, and they bring the flutes and trumpets into the central bit, and the initiates, you're not allowed to sit on anything above the ground. You have to sit on the floor. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed any contact with fire, and you're at the critical point, you're told to stand with your hands raised above your head, and you're whipped across your upper arms, lower arms, chest, genitals, upper thighs and lower thighs. And
what with?
With a kind of, it's the stick, it's like a, you know those long hazel rods? That,
yeah.
It's like that, but with many branches on it. And they peel off the bark, and this is the whip they whip you with.
Is this while you're still on ayahuasca?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And this goes on lasts for about 24 hours. You're high as a kite and cold and hungry and not allowed to move fast, etc. It is quite impressive, actually.
How did you feel when this was happening to you? Were you just kind of very much sort of... because I imagine you didn't know what was going to happen to you, so you were I'm just going to go with the flow here.
I didn't know what was happening, but at the same time, I was desperately trying to remember everything because I wasn't allowed to write notes, so I was... high as a kite, inventing mnemonics to try and remember the sequence of events. Luckily, Christine was in the back writing notes furiously. And actually, the women are supposed not to know anything about it, but they know it. Of course, they know a lot.
Yeah.
And they were saying, although the women are supposed to think that it's the secret spirits coming in, they'd say, oh, that's Jose playing the flute there. And
it's the theater, though, isn't it?
Well,
this, you know, ritual has, there is an aspect of theater in ritual.
Exactly. I mean, it's not what the women do or not don't know, it's what the women are allowed to say that they know in public.
Sure.
And that's part of the gender thing, is that they say that when you've been through this rite, you're like a menstruating woman. And so, and the original power of creation came from the women and is still lodged in the women's bodies, so that the flutes and trumpets, there's a sense in which the flutes and trumpets are simultaneously male penises, but they're also female vaginas, because when in the beginning of time, the women stole the flutes and trumpets from the men, and then the men started menstruating, and the women and did the women's work, and the women were powerful and became like men. When the men took their flutes and trumpets back from the women, they punished the women by ramming the flutes and trumpets into their bodies, which caused them to bleed and gave them their vaginas. So there's the logic of that.
That's fascinating.
The logic of that is that male penises and female vaginas are inverted or everted versions of each other.
Sure.
And that male and female creativity is the same, which it is. I mean, both sides required for reproduction, etc.
So are they saying in that sort of origin story, which I imagine is based on, you know, stories that have been passed on and passed down. So are they saying that at one point there was a reversal of the main roles in terms of women were hunters? Is that what they're saying?
That's what they're saying. And the kind of the easy cop-out explanation of this is that it's all about male power and female power. And in one sense it is, but that's actually much too easy cop-out, because what it's also about is we assume that men and women are obviously different, and that the shape of our genitals and the sex is for us the most important difference. But actually, this is relatively recent. If we go back to Greek ideas, they start from the opposite premise, which is actually that men and women are only too similar, and the problem is how to make them different. And this is more the Amazonian take, which is that far from being different genitals of versions of each other. And that relates to the flutes and trumpets, because what lies behind all this is that basically creativity, fertility and life comes from what goes on through the tubes of your body. And so that's not only sex, but that's also what you say. Your mouth produces air, which produces your speech, which is also your creativity. Your hands are like tubes which create objects. And so behind all this, there's a whole philosophy of the idea of bodies as tubes, so that the people I work with will say, well, of course, people are flutes. And what they mean by that is not just that they're like musical instruments because they sing, but also that flutes are magical breath, musical breath, and that breath is what gives us life, and breath is what gives us poetry and music and thought, etc. So that this idea of the body as a flute or the body as a tube is actually quite complicated. And that's why I'm writing a paper about the spirit without anus, because if you ain't got an anus, you have got no flow through your body.
nowhere for it to go.
Yeah.
So what's the spirit without an anus about?
The spirit without an anus is, the story is that there was this spirit without an anus who ate his neighbor's children. And needless to say, his neighbor was very upset, and the spirit ate the neighbor's children. The spirit put his neighbor's children into a cooking pot and boiled them alive. And
wow.
And their father fished them out and brought them back to life, and they turned into monkeys. But then the father killed the spirit in revenge. By what he did was he farted, and the spirit said, "Hey, how did you do that?" And the man said, "Well, obviously with my anus." And the spirit said, "Well, I haven't got an anus. Look, my backside's all smooth and shiny." And the guy said, "Oh, well, I can fix that. I made anuses for all my children, and I can make one for you too. Bend over and I'll do it for you." And what he does, he hammers a stick into the body of the spirit, gives him an anus, but the spirit dies, and from his flesh, that the flesh is the origin of pottery clay.
Ah.
Now, if you follow this, the spirit is actually already the pot, because he is the pot which ate the children.
Okay.
Just as Juru Peri was the the trumpet that, or the flute that ate the children in initiation.
Mm.
So, and the spirit without an anus is a pot, because, as you know, any decent pot doesn't have an anus. It doesn't leak. So that's the origin of pottery clay. And I mean, and the, so most pots don't have an anus, but if I went next door, I could bring you a clay pot trumpet, which has got a hole in the bottom which, through which you blow, and it makes one hell of a noise. And this is the spirit now with an anus and very well able to fart. In other words, trumpets make farty noises.
Wow, that's amazing. I love that story. So
so that's what keeps me out of mischief, is writing papers about obscure Amazonian mythology about tubes and...
Did you meet any spirits without anuses when you were during your initiation experience? Or any kind of... Did you have any sort of meetings with spirits in the ayahuasca space?
I did have... Not exactly. I had what they... What happens when you take ayahuasca is that you take it only under these ritual conditions. Mm. The kind of priest shaman dishes it out.
Yeah.
And...
I just, so you know, I've had an experience with it myself.
Oh, right.
In
yeah.
South America. So in Ecuador, well, with the Napa Runa.
Did it make you vomit?
Yes. It was just very, very much about this kind of being held by the cosmic mother and having a deep kind of connection to the spirit of the plant.
Well, I've taken it lots and lots of times, and it usually makes me vomit and sometimes gives me diarrhea. In other words, it opens up my tubes. And when I took it during the initiation rite, which was a really heavy dose of it, my visions were that my sense, my sight, hearing, etc., turned into a little red light, which left my body and went off touring. And, you know, I mean, you talk to other people on these trips. So
you had no sense of Stephen? Or did you still have some sense of Stephen?
I didn't have a sense of Stephen. I had a sense of something, a sort of consciousness, which was a little red light going off, all doing things and having adventures.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I then came back to my body and found my body was just a heap of bones lying on the floor. And then I started panicking.
Right.
I mean, one of the effects that I, for me, of ayahuasca is that it starts being all right and then it goes and it gets more and more and more and more intense. And at that moment, you have to control yourself and vomit, because if you don't control yourself and vomit, then it gets really nasty.
Mm.
So anyhow, in this ayahuasca trip, I had turned into a little red light and I was now trying to reassemble my bones in order to get back into my body. And you know the song, your left hand is connected to your right hand. I was sort of like trying to remember which bit goes where, and kept getting it wrong and thinking, oh God, I'm never going to have another body. What am I going to do?
Is this going on whilst, are they playing the flutes at this point?
Yeah. They were shouting at me saying, Stephen, go and put some more pitch on the light post. It's getting dark. And I saying, I can't. I haven't got a body. Hang on. And come on, Stephen. We want more light. No, I can't.
Was this a test, do you think? Or were they literally just asking you to do something practical?
Oh, no, they were just asking me to do something practical. They were asking me a perfectly ordinary question, giving me a perfectly ordinary command.
That's hilarious that they thought that you would just be able to do that.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. And I was, when I told them this afterwards, they said, oh, yeah, you see, you really had it right, because that's what the story about Juru Parry is about. What happens to Juru Parry is that in revenge, he eats the initiates, and in revenge, their fathers burn his body on a fire. And from the fire, a palm tree grows, and they cut up the palm tree to make flutes and trumpets, which okay. are the bones.
The bones, yeah.
So that when my ayahuasca trip was a kind of Jurupari trip, because I had turned into bones, which are effectively flutes and trumpets. But
it's a classic kind of sort of shamanic,
yeah,
you know, dissemblement and then put back together again, exactly, you know, that yeah, kind of thing. Yeah. Mm.
So anyhow, when you take ayahuasca in this part of Amazonia, they always ask you the morning after the rituals. They always say, okay, well, Stephen, tell me what happened to you. And so you tell her the story. And then the elders, the knowledgeable elders, give you a kind of symbolic commentary. And so they were saying, oh, well, this is, you know, this is just what you should have been experiencing, because that's precisely it. And I mean, what happens when you take in, you know, I was working for nearly 2 years there to begin with, and there's a kind of feedback process, because when I first took ayahuasca, my visions were kind of basically English. But the more I
sure.
spent my days and weeks and months learning the about their cosmology and ideas, the more...
And living in the forest.
And living there,
yeah.
the more my visions were precisely about that world, not my world, or not this world.
Mm.
So that... When I told them this ayahuasca vision during initiation, they said, oh, right, yeah, that's just what you should have been seeing.
Tick.
Yeah, yeah. Tick.
Well done.
You pass your exam.
And so is that the main kind of, you said that was sort of the early part of the initiation. Is it then kind of, is there a period after the ayahuasca experience when you're kind of fasting or?
Yeah. Yeah, what happens, the rite goes on like about 24 hours, right. and then you're basically dead. And during a month, you're basically confined in, although we weren't, you should be confined in a little compartment, which they construct, but they didn't do that for us. They just confined us in the front of the house, and you have to eat everything. You have to eat very limited diet of ant heads and small fish, nothing with any blood in it.
Yeah.
And you have to eat all your manioc bread off the end of a toothpick. You mustn't open your mouth wide. You must control all the holes in your body.
Hmm.
Is that
specific? Is that kind of thing specific to their mythology around the process? I mean, would other tribes maybe not have those?
No, this is very specific to this area. But yeah. the logic is that when men and women or boys and girls grow up, their bodies open. In other words, men produce semen and women produce menstrual blood. And yeah. they become adults with adult capacities. And the rite is, in a sense, designed to open your body. But if you're too open, you have to be a balance between closed is sterile, too open is the opposite.
Right.
So that all this stuff about eating off toothpicks and you you talk through like a tube through your hand,
oh, wow.
talk with your fist in a tube over your mouth, so that you've been opened, because you have to be open to be a reproductive and productive, visually, verbally, etc., adult.
Mm-hmm.
But you mustn't be too open, because either you'll be a cannibal or all the stuff will leak out of your body. So that's what all of these rituals stuff. And the black paint on your body is a sign partly of death, that you're dead.
As you're going into this
But
death
it
process.
Also serves as it blocks up. You paint when you're fully initiated, when you go through a ritual, the soft bits of your body are painted with patterns, but your knee joints and your ankle joints and your hands and your shoulders and your elbows are all painted with black bands, because your notionally your bones are flutes, and they soul power comes out of your joints or can come out of your joints. Okay. So that by putting black bands on your joints, you control the exits of your...
It's like sealing.
Exactly.
Sealing,
So what happens... So during this month or 2 month period of fasting, your body paint slowly fades, which is interpreted as a change of skin. And snakes and things who change their skins don't die. They live eternally. They renew themselves. So that this fading of the body paint is a renewal of your life. And when it's faded, at the end of your 2 month period of fasting and vomiting every morning and bathing, etc., you then go through another ritual where things are reversed. At the first ritual, you're painted with black and not allowed to have any contact with fire and not allowed to have any contact with women.
Yeah.
At the end of all this, the women come in, paint you from head to toe in red, and you're made to drink hot liquid with chili peppers in. In other words, you're given fire on steroids.
Oh my God.
And then you go through a big ritual dance where you join up back, you dance with the women. And during your period of seclusion, you learn to make basketry, etc. You're learning to be a productive adult.
Oh, wow.
And at the ritual at the end of where you've spent your month in seclusion learning to make the products which women need for making their manioc, which is the basketry which the men make. I could show it to you. It's just outside here. Mm. The initiates then give their ceremonial partners, who are like a sort of ceremonial wife, the basketry which they've made in their seclusion, so that the end of the ritual inverts all the procedures that start. You go from black to red, no fire to full fire, no women to all women, etc., etc., etc. So that is what is enacted, is partly it's a rebirth as an adult, but it's also you're now a productive flute. In other words, from your hands flows material goods, from your mouth flows adult speech, etc. You're an adult.
So, did you notice they treated you differently after you went through this?
Very much so, yes. I mean, I was given a new name, which is the name... Each group, each of these language groups owns a stock of names, which are their ancestral names. And when you're given a name, you're given the name of a dead grandparent, so that the names are what lives on. You're not reincarnated, but you bear an eternal name. Your body, which is mortal, bears an immortal name. So I have, my name is Mahakotia, or Macaw's Ribs, which is one of these sacred names. So that, so that now that I have one of these names, this is their reference point. They keep saying, "Yes, well, you're one of us because you have one of our names."
That must have felt like quite an honor.
Yeah, and more recently, I mean, this is all. Most of this went on in 68 to 71. Then we went back in 79 with our kids, who also have Amerindian names.
Did you encourage them to go through the initiation process?
They haven't done that yet, or they could have. But then in 79, the Colombian government, the Colombians... changed their constitution. Sorry, in 91, they changed their constitution to stop the Catholic missionaries teaching the Indians up to chuck out their culture, none of this devil worship, etc. The Indians were given the right to run their own culture and their own education.
Wow, 91 sounds late for that.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, this was a new constitution which changed all sorts of things, but it recognized the country as pluri-ethnic and multicultural. And
was this part of something more widespread that was happening across the continent at the time, or was it more...
Yes, it's a movement which has happened worldwide where indigenous peoples have been given rights, but it was particularly bound up in Colombia with the long history of guerrilla warfare. It was the beginnings of the process of making peace with the FARC, etc. Anyhow, as part of that, the people we work with sent messages back to us saying, sort of, come back, all is forgiven. We are now allowed to run our own education. You know about our culture. Will you come and help us develop a program of education which is simultaneously not destructive of our own culture, but which allows us to learn what we need to know about everything. I mean, we need to know about maths, we need to know reading, writing, chemistry, physics, biology, etc.
Like a bridge to the sort of Western modern society.
They talk about it as the two sides of a river. So I went back the meeting was in 96, and I went back in 98, I think it was, to run a program of... to organize a course for training the new teacher leaders they were already literate and they'd been through the mission schools. And we developed a program of education together, which was partly based on their own research, so that because they'd been through the missionary schools, they were in a sense well-educated in outsiders' knowledge, but badly educated in their own knowledge, because they hadn't, they'd missed out on quite a lot, because they'd spent their time in school, they'd missed out on education at home, which is precisely what I had, because I mean, I'd spent my life educating myself in their stuff. So they said, come back.
So you were uniquely placed, really, to offer something like that.
And I mean, I could also give them, we had sort of classes where I could not only speak in their language, but I could also, what I did was to start by explain to them, look, there are three kinds of knowledge that we're dealing with. There's stuff that you know that you know, which is basically your own culture. And that's what I've spent my life learning. And then there's stuff that you know, but you don't know you know, which is things like basic, I mean, they know a lot of physics because they know perfectly well that if you hit a big, wet, soggy log, it goes boom. And if you hit a very light, hard wood piece of wood, it goes bing. They use levers all the time. They know one hell of a lot about the interior organization of animals because they hunt them. Mm. They know much more than we do about this. You know, they can identify frogs from their sounds, etc. They have a huge... there's lots of stuff they know, but they didn't know that as biology, and they use chemical processes, but they didn't know that as chemistry, etc. So that's the component that they knew but didn't know they knew.
Sure.
And then there was stuff they didn't know and had to know, a lot of which is stuff like, what the hell is money? I mean, most Europeans don't really know what money is because they're not told it. And so that's an example of, or what is a government? I mean, they imagine the government as a powerful person who sits in Bogota, just as we imagine God as a white bearded figure who sits up in heaven, neither of which is true. And so that was the component of stuff that they didn't know and they had to know. And they kept, we invited them to ask questions so that they said, well, for instance, what is writing? We know how to write, but where does writing come from? Who invented it? So that we explain writing, etc. So that was, and that education program has gone on. And one of the things is that one of the bases of this is that the teachers must be educated so that before they can teach, they have to know about reading, writing, etc., etc., but they must also know about their own culture so that they are required to learn with the elders, just as I learned with the elders, as part of their teaching. To be a qualified teacher, they must know their own culture, and they also invite the elders to come and do the teaching too. So that, and it's been a very successful program.
Wow, that's amazing. That's so great. Wow, that must feel really rewarding from your side as well to be.
It was great. It was great.
How has your relationship with them evolved more recently? Have you been back? Like, how are things kind of?
I go back as much as I can. It's bloody expensive to get there.
Sure.
But I mean, I've lost count of the number of times I've been there, because I mean, periodically they ask me to get, every so often there are evaluation programs to evaluate this education. And we've done special workshops. We've done one on outsiders technology, which is, you know, what the hell is a computer? Yeah. What are the advantages and disadvantages of computers? What are the advantages and disadvantages of the internet, etc.? So that was one course. Then they had another course on sacred sites, because they have, it's a bit like Australia. They have sort of song lines or chant lines, and these sacred sites are also, a lot of them are also ecologically important, as places where fish breed or places where forest fruit is found, etc. So that the young teachers were doing research on their own sacred sites, and they were asking me to explain, but we were discussing, because some of them know about it already, but we were sharing our knowledge about the mythological basis of these sacred sites. So that, for instance, an example would be that there are sacred sites where curare poison is found. Now they use shotguns, but they used to use curare poison. And the story is that a guy shot an eagle with a blowpipe, and the eagle flew around with his blood dripping down. And every place that his blood fell is a place where curare vines grow, because he'd been shot with poison. So that you can read the myth as a catalogue or a guide as to where all the places where you will find curare. And at the same time as this eagle died, he sang the verses of the song called Eagle Song, which they sing in their dances. So that verse one is, the dart has hit me. So verse two is, bloody hurts. Verse three is, my blood is dripping, etc. So that the process of and each of these verses is sung over all night dance, so that the song recreates the story and reenacts the story, and at the same time the story is a guidebook to where the poison is found. And all of these stories are like that. All their mythology, which looks like just fantasy stories, is actually full of ecological, philosophical, etc. knowledge. And that's what the teachers have to understand in order to teach.
And is that similar for like the other pharmacopoeia that they have in their culture? Are there sort of stories behind how they came to use ayahuasca or tobacco?
Yes. Wow. So, I mean, the story of ayahuasca, and this is back to gender and women, is that the story of ayahuasca was that a woman became pregnant with ayahuasca. The ayahuasca was her child. And as she gave birth, the blood from her birth saturated the longhouse. And for the men, that blood was songs, designs, patterns, all the things that you see and hear, which are kind of synesthetically linked up. When you take ayahuasca, you hear color and you see sounds, etc. And so that this blood of ayahuasca's birth made the men stoned or gave them visions. And when the baby was born, they then pulled it to pieces, and from his fingers and toes were all the different ayahuasca vines, which is, if you follow it, it's like the story of Jurupari, because from Jurupari's body was also taken to pieces and made into flutes and trumpets. So all these things sort of fit together.
And Do they have, I mean, I'm curious to know if they have any opinion on the sort of proliferation of ayahuasca use in the Western world at all. It's something that's obviously been growing quite prominently across North America, Europe, Australia, etc. in the past sort of 10 years. Do they have any opinions on, you know, something that is a sacred medicine being used by the West?
They know about it and they don't like it. What happens, I mean, this, what happened is that particularly on the eastern slopes of the Andes in Peru, particularly in Peru, but also in Ecuador and southern Colombia, you got a kind of a mixture. The Indians there had already been educated and had contact with Catholic missionaries. And the Catholic missionaries brought their own, when you imagine Catholic missionaries going to the Amazon in the 18th century, they couldn't take anti-malaria pills. They took plants as their medicines. So that what happened on the eastern slopes of the Andes was a fusion between Western pharmacopoeias and indigenous pharmacopoeias, so that, for instance, the in that area, the Indians or the shamans use alcohol. They make a lot of distillations of bark in alcohol, mm-hmm. which is basically a Western technology applied to indigenous drugs. In fact,
right.
Angostura bitters, which people put in their gin and tonic, is an example of precisely that technology.
Yeah.
And the ayahuasca shamanism, which is all over Iquitos in Peru, etc., is the result of this fusion. So that ayahuasca, if you look at the biographies of ayahuasca shamans or look them up on the internet, many of them have been educated in have a Catholic education. Ayahuasca shamanism is linked up with spiritualism and all sorts of other. It's a hybrid mixture.
And then you've got the kind of extreme end of that, like the Santo Daime.
Exactly. All of that stuff is the interface between us and indigenous cultures. And whereas the image of the real ayahuasca is the more Indian it is, the more authentic it is. But actually in the ayahuasca shamanism of Peru, etc., is this hybrid mixture. In fact, I've just been writing another paper with a friend. We went and did a lot of research on ayahuasca shamanism in Iquitos. What we were interested in was cataloguing all the plants in these shamans' gardens, and we're just about to publish this.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that ayahuasca shamanism is the product of the interaction between the West and the rest, or Indians and non-Indians. Whereas the guys that I work with haven't developed this ayahuasca shamanism because they've basically been isolated from outside influences. So that people they know about, people do come looking for ayahuasca, but they don't like it because for them, this is something which is reserved for them as a very special part of us, not you.
Right.
From their perspective, they don't like tourists. They don't like visitors. They close their. They don't want outsiders coming and visiting them in large numbers because they're worried about losing their territory and worried about losing the integrity of their own culture.
Rightfully so.
Yeah, yeah. So that the answer is their kind of shamanism isn't the shamanism that most people understand Peru, by shamanism.
Yeah.
And their kind of ayahuasca is the same stuff, but it ain't the same stuff as I mean, if you go to Iquitos, the first thing you're offered is an ayahuasca trip. So
yeah, very different.
Yeah, very different.
Okay, interesting. What just going back to what you're saying about your current work, what's the paper that you're talking about with the you were just mentioning about the different plants and things.
Well, we got interested.
About the ingredients of brew specifically, and what if they use like Jacruno or not, yeah, and that kind of thing. And
well, lots of people, there's been a lot of literature about ayahuasca shamanism, but what interested us was that if you go to the Iquitos area, there are these things called shamanism or ayahuasca lodges. And at each ayahuasca lodge, has what they usually call an ethno or a botanical garden or an ethno-botanical garden. And many of them actually have, they have little labels, like when you go to an ordinary botanical gardens. And the shamans keep these gardens partly because they need to grow their supplies of ayahuasca and chacruna, etc. But also it's part of the tourist experience is to find out about the jungle and its
and
pharmacological
see
riches.
The pictures of the people who go to the retreats are involved in pounding the vines.
And exactly. So masses of people have written about ayahuasca shamanism, but virtually nobody has ever paid attention to the garden. So what I did with my friend Francoise, who works in Cambridge, is we went some time ago to Iquitos and we spent time mapping every single plant in a shaman's garden. It took ages and it was very difficult to do, and we took photographs, and I mean, both of us have some botanical knowledge, and so we made this map of all the plants in the garden and why the plants were where they were, because there are male plants and female plants and red plants and white. There's quite a complicated symbolic logic, and you have to combine ayahuasca with chacruna, and there are various other.
And some people put a bit of this in, and some people put a bit of that in, and you know.
Yeah. So all of this stuff is laid out in the gardens, but nobody had ever paid much attention to the gardens. So we just thought it would be very interesting to document what a shaman. I mean, we couldn't do it for every shaman's garden. We haven't got time, but given that this is a standard element of ayahuasca shamanism, we thought that to document one shaman's garden in detail would be really interesting. So we worked with this guy called Don Gilbert Chafundama, and we traveled with him. We went to his home territory, which was quite a long way away from near Pucallpa, and we came back in an aeroplane with him with boxes full of all the new cuttings that he and plants he'd collected amongst other shamans, because the shamans all trade the plants with each other and grow them in their gardens. So that's what this paper is about, is a paper called Shaman's Gardens.
I'm really interested in that. That'll be a fascinating read. Is that going to be publicly available, or is that in a journal or something?
I mean, we've just finished it as a paper. We've now got to hawk it round for a publisher. It's a bit technical in that it's it's got lists. What we show is that there is a standard it's like every ayahuasca shaman has usually his own plants, but most of them are a standard, very standard list. But each one has his own particular additions, which reflect his own knowledge and life experience. So that's what the paper is about.
But you also, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are female ayahuasca areas.
Most of them are male. Where I work in Amazonia, most, virtually all the ritual experts are male. But there are some people who know one hell of a lot, and there are female ritual experts. Yeah.
So what's next for you then, Stephen, after you get this paper out? Are you going back to the mythology side of things, or what's kind of got your interest for the looking ahead a little bit?
One of the things I want to write about is the history of these people, this story of what exactly happened when they killed the rubber gatherers is very interesting, because this is a key moment in their history, because this is why this river called the Piedra Paraná survived and their culture survived, was basically because they in the 30s they killed some rubber gatherers out of desperation, but this gave them the reputation for being dangerous killers, plus the fact that the river is extremely dangerous to travel because it's full of rapids, it's very difficult and quite isolated. That was why that area in particular, the culture in that area, survived. So I thought my next thing is to write a story about this, a guy called Cordoba, who was a Cordoba was an Indian, a headman of one of these longhouses, who was in hock with the rubber gatherers, so that he would get, the rubber gatherers would give him lots of merchandise, axes, machetes, etc., in exchange for him basically enslaving his own people and making them work for the rubber gatherers. And the story of Cordoba and Cordoba's death and the death of the rubber gatherers is what I want to next write about. Yeah.
Oh, wow, exciting.
Because it's such an important story, because it explains the survival of this group.
And it makes me think of what happened in Peru recently, where the some of the indigenous people who were suffering with all the oil pipeline leaks, they took a group and just said, well, you're not leaving this. A group of tourists, I think it was, primarily Peruvians and a few British people. And did you read about that? And they said, we're not going to let you go because we need to make a point, because no one's listening to us.
Yes, exactly.
This is destroying our fishing areas, and the Peruvian government aren't helping. And obviously it made the national news as held hostage by Indians. But it's kind of really, they were desperate as well.
Well, exactly. No, I mean,
there's no other way to raise awareness for them.
Yes, exactly. That's...
So yeah, that, I think that you're right. That's deeply important to document. But I could talk to you for probably hours, but I feel like we've been going a good time, so maybe I'll wrap this up.
Well, it's a pleasure.
No, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you, Stephen. Absolutely fascinating. Do you have a website or anything where you have your papers or anything like that at all, or are you not really?
Have a website. I have endless papers which I can supply if people want them, but
good. Probably better that way, isn't it? Leave all that stuff. Who needs a website?
Yeah. No, I would like to have a website, but
can talk about that, because I make websites.
Oh,
as well.
Great. Well, you can help me make a website and I stick up all this rubbish.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Thank
you. No, it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
No, I was going to say, I mean, I feel that it's terribly important that people like me talk about this stuff, partly because my research was funded by the British taxpayers, so that I feel that it's public benefit. Although Christine and I were cited by Margaret Thatcher, what the hell is the use? Why is the British taxpayer wasting its money on studies of Amazonian shamanism? Well, I hope I've given you the answer. But it's also, I think, I give talks at the Prestine Primary School because I think it's important that people,
that's
academics,
brilliant,
share their knowledge and make it accessible. So
I love that it's the primary school as well. Like getting in there early with this kind of spreading the cultural.
We did a brilliant thing because I was the farmer's wife who owns the farm in which we're living. She teaches there, and she asked me to give one of these talks. And I said, well, actually, I happened just soon after this talk, I happened to be going back to the Amazon. Would you like it? If the kids in Prestine Primary School wrote letters to the kids in the primary school in the Amazon, I could take those letters, read them to the kids in the Amazon, and get the kids in the Amazon to write letters back again, which is what we did.
That's so good. And did that happen?
It happened. And I mean, everything worked. I mean, the kids in the Amazon were absolutely chuffed to get letters from their friends in Prestine. And the kids in Prestine, the kids in the Amazon wrote back with pictures of bows and arrows and blowpipes and crocodiles in the river and everything else, pressing all the right buttons. So it was
That's
brilliant.
That's amazing. Yeah. Imagine what that does for their sort of imagination and the possibilities of, they might inspire the next generation anthropologists. Even.
One of them, I gave the talk again this year, and one of them wrote back and said, when I grow up, I'm going to the Amazon.
And the cycle continues.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Hi, it's Jody again. Thank you as always to Six Organs of Admittance for the intro and outro music, also known as Ben Chasney, and Drag City Records. And you can find his music at sixorgans.com or dragcityrecords.com. To keep in touch with me, you can follow my personal Instagram, which is Life in Fractals. To keep up with the podcast episodes, it is Lumiere's Podcast on Instagram. And you can check out my website, jodywhite.co.uk, for all sorts of other things related to the work that I do, and my book, Chimera, which is out now and available at all good online retailers and a very select few independent bookshops. It's also available on bookshop.org if you'd rather not support Jeffrey Bezos. All the links are at my website, jodywhite.co.uk/chimera. And if you really enjoyed this episode and you're thinking, hey, how can I support Jody make more of these podcasts and continue to go out and meet and talk to wonderful, interesting, inspiring people, then you can. You can go to patreon.com/Jody White. And if you choose to do so, my deepest thanks to you in advance.
We found our way. La, la, la.